We're recapping last night's Game 3 of the NBA Finals. We talk about the suits we wore to the game and the questions facing Luka Doncic going forward. We also talk about the coaching carousel, where there are currently open jobs in LA, in Cleveland, and still maybe Detroit. That and a whole lot more coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends. Welcome to No Cap Room. My name is Jake Fisher, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. I'm in Dallas after Game 3 of the NBA Finals. Also in Dallas, but not actually in the same hotel room as me, senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports. It's my man. It's your man. It's everyone's man. He was wearing a beautiful blue suit last night. It's Dan Devine. What's up?
Not much. You're going to see that blue suit again, because as it turns out, I didn't pack two of them. I do have a different shirt and a different tie, but same suit. So
wait. TV turns out as if this is a surprise that you learned this morning? As if you
I was aware of it this morning, but you weren't aware of it until just now. So
I was not.
It's new information for you. And as an information broker, I'm sure you appreciate getting this new information.
Thank you.
But I didn't get the memo. You and Vinny both had like beautiful maroon kind of suits, and I was not on the same page. But Vinny told me I was accenting him, so that was good.
Yeah.
We sat next to each other, and he said I was like basically accentuating what he was bringing to the table, which is what I really always try to do on mic or off.
So real listeners, real members of the NCAA Armada will
real
remember
heads know.
That I dressed up in suit and a bow tie in honor of Monty McCutcheon, but also to rise to the occasion of the quality of dress that both Vinny and Dan were bringing on the ground to the finals last year, while my ridiculous wedding schedule, where I went to 17 weddings in 2023, did not allow me to attend the finals. Too many conflicts. I would not have been able to have gone to Game 7 of this series because of another wedding. Thankfully, the Boston Celtics are not making that an issue or a conflict, because they are now up 3-0 after a 106-99 victory. But before we get into the basketball, I just want to elaborate on Dan's suiting discussions, because Vinny and my parents and a lot of people have kind of given me shit over the years for like not like wearing a sport coat to events as such. I remember sitting in Adam Silver's press conference at All-Star Weekend 2022, my last with Bleacher Report, and Mark Stein, the dean of Dallas. I was wearing a beanie and a corduroy plaid thing to Adam Silver's press conference at All-Star Weekend, and he was like, "If you're gonna be someone I mentor, you can't fucking dress like that, my guy." So
I am. You know, there's been like the sort of viral prompt recently about like, what's your most boomer take? And I think you've seen Jake. I'm pretty far from a clothes horse and a snappy dresser. This is not exactly the area in which I am most comfortable. But I generally think that if you're going to a big thing, especially like the fucking championship round, I don't know, maybe, yeah, put on a suit, put on a coat and pants. Oh, no, I'm not saying you. I'm saying, yeah. I think that there are. I think we can do better. You know, I think we're all trying to do better tomorrow. And I think maybe some of us could try to do better tomorrow a little more than others.
Well, I've been trying. I've worn a suit or a blazer in some capacity to every playoff game since the conference finals round. So there you go there.
I was going to say, yeah, rounds and one and two, you can show up how you live. But you know, when it gets to be close to the big gold ball, you got to step the game up.
I had some jackets for the second round, Dallas Mavericks victory over Oklahoma City. But yeah, that's all led us to, I brought a brown suit and a maroon suit for games 3 and 4 here. And I just, choosing between the two, I picked maroon, and I show up a little flustered because my Uber took like 25 minutes just to get to my hotel. And I had terrible Uber issues on the way out last night, not to complain. But then I show up frazzled. I get my wristband thingy to get into the locker room. All I wanted to do was be there on time to talk to Xavier Tillman. Spoiler alert, because I think the story will come out before this pod airs. I saw him pregame game 2 doing a Sudoku, like quietly, calmly at his locker room, or at his locker pregame. And I had a suspicion that he would be the one inserted into Kristaps Porzingis' role, for game three. So I talked to him about that. Then there was a mad goose chase of Vinny and I trying to run around to find these like Dave and Buster's cards for the media meal in the concession stands. And as we walked under the bowels of American Airlines Center, as Dan was trying to find our third seat, thanks to NBA PR, like literally everyone from Deputy Commissioner Mark Tatum to Tim Hardaway Sr. to everyone in the back of the NBA communications office basically called me and Vinny Tweedledee, Tweedledum in our matching suits to the point where at the end of this goose chase, at the end of this rainbow where the pot of gold was a little plastic card that got us $23 or whatever to buy chicken fingers. NBA Cobb says, oh, you guys are so cute. Like, you should take a picture. Vinny and I both just went, no, we're not.
Wait a second. You mean that Vinny wasn't like psyched at the idea of taking a cute picture? That doesn't sound right at all. That sounds wild.
You know who's going to be taking cute pictures on Friday night after they win the title?
The Boston Celtics. I thought that was a rhetorical question, but then you paused for me to answer. We saw game three, and what we saw was something that looked pretty similar in a lot of ways to game two, I think. Like, the Mavericks just kind of can't get what they want going, and the Celtics can get whatever they want whenever they want, pretty much. And that is a recipe for a short and abrupt series.
It's been short so far. It looks like it's going to be short. And yeah, abrupt in a way, to use to go off of your word, having been in the building and like, I'm a vibesman, right? We've discussed this. We're feeling, we're observing, we're writing what we see. You can really get a sense, I think, when like the air in the building gets sucked out. And boy, did it happen in Dallas last night before a great 20-2 run in the fourth quarter, and I made it close. And that was fun. To be there was fun. But there's been a moment in every game. It was that third quarter run in game two. And it was the third quarter run in game three last night for sure, where Boston, I mean, the two Jays outscored Dallas by themselves by a pretty wide margin. And it was so amazing at the end of the third quarter. Because part of my joy of this postseason run, I have reflected upon, is like traveling around all these different kingdoms. You know, the sports world is pretty tribalistic. You see the differences of what happens on the Jumbotron, and everyone does the same thing now, where at the middle of in between quarter break, they're like these kind of large, like almost flag looking things where you can like flap them, and they pull them to the side, and it goes, Boston Celtics, get loud. And then the mascot's in the middle. Dallas does this thing where Kyrie gets on the board and he's like, don't be boring, Mavericks fans. And they're like, AAC, turn the volume up. And they pan to Pat Mahomes courtside and Dirk, and like no one wanted any of it. The crowd was getting ready for a funeral. I actually thought maybe, as an Eagles fan, I thought maybe the Dallas crowd was getting ready to boo their own players. That did not happen. But the energy got sucked out of that building. I don't know if snapping on the microphone is going to kill any producers' eardrums or any of our listeners, but I just did it because, man, did Boston just deliver a knockout punch? Sure, the Mavs got back up and whatever. But that third quarter, when Jaylen Brown smelled blood in the water, ended it with that ridiculous hammer dunk. The way he can explode off just like 1 foot anywhere in the paint is remarkable, like truly remarkable. And he had the same exact right to left crossover through the legs that he used to spring into a dunk. He used the same thing, I believe it was on Derrick Jones Jr. for that big pull-up mid-range in the fourth quarter. Like
Tim Hardaway Jr. with a minute left. Yeah, which that's part of the reason that, yeah, I mean, Dallas was like, well, look, we got to wind the clock way back. The Celtics beat the Mavericks 106-99 in game three of the NBA Finals.
On the off chance
that you're getting spoiled here. Take a 3-0 lead. You have finally had Jason Tatum have a breakout offensive first half, finish with 31 points. Yep. Blowing kisses to the crowd.
Blowing kisses to the crowd.
Finally got a couple of pull-up threes to go, which feels like he hasn't hit one of those in about 6 weeks. As you mentioned, Jaylen Brown, 15 points in the third quarter as the Celtics just completely took control of the game at a halftime, assisted on eight more points in that quarter. So he created 23 in the third quarter. Dallas scored 19 as a team. Also, Jaylen Brown finished with a career playoff high 8 assists, which is, you know, like all of the conversations we've had over the years about, like, you know, Tatum can do this, but he can't do that. Brown can do this, but he can't do that. They're showing the growths of their games every single night at this point in the postseason, and it's a huge reason why the Celtics have gotten to within one win of the title. It turns out Kristaps Porzingis, not no problem, but as you mentioned, Joe Mazzulla had espoused confidence. He'd been like, we're, you know, next man up, and we feel like we've got enough to be able to make it work the way we need to. Goes to the bench. Xavier Tillman had not played in the finals, had only played really limited minutes for most of the playoff run. Comes in and goes right into the mix, like switching on ball screens, containing Luka Doncic, hitting the glass, couple of blocks, hits a huge corner three that I think was a real, Jesus Christ, this guy's making shots, like heartbreaker for Dallas fans. At no point did it feel like the Mavericks had meaningfully changed the terms of engagement from games 1 and 2. And it continues to be a series where the Celtics are able to get pretty much whatever shot they want whenever they want to get it, as I mentioned earlier. And I think a big part of that, as you wrote about, is just the ability to target Luka Doncic wherever he goes on the floor.
Yeah, if we want to take it that direction, let's take it that direction. Because, look, I know I've spent way too much of this show reflecting and recalling back
about
my time. No. I think there needs to be more discussion about
it. We probably should keep that in and double it, yeah.
I've definitely recalled my times in Manila and things I saw at the FIBA World Cup far too many. But these are important data points that you collect and you remember. And when they somehow connect to another data point down the line, it's like, aha, that's partially why we justified the travel budget to send me there. And I remember being so psyched going into the Slovenia-Canada quarterfinal matchup because Shea was this on-the-rise figure, Luka, on-the-rise figure. These two first-team All-NBA guys, they end up being 2 and 3 in the MVP voting this year. I wanted to see which one, away from their NBA team settings, was going to stand out. I came away in that game not only impressed by how Shea was the best player on the floor, but also very displeased by how Luka Doncic comported himself both with the officials and on defense, which has been things that we've been reflecting on, and I don't want to say criticizing him for, because it's just been commentary throughout his entire career. But at this stage now, he deserves criticism. I was on the phone. I landed in Dallas yesterday, did a group. I called a buddy in the league. He's like, hey, I'm on the phone with this coach. Let's patch in. Do a 3-man call. And we're just shooting this shit, going over what we think we can expect for the game. And they asked me, what are the angles you're preparing to write for tonight? And I was thinking about this from game 2, because with one of these friends, we were texting during it, and he was saying, wow, Luka's on-ball defense is horrendous. This is game 2 on Sunday. And I said, well, the problem is I think his off-ball defense is worse. We both can make an argument and both be right.
Yeah.
Because he was just matadoring people on the ball. So many of Drew Holiday's back cuts in game 2 was because Luka was looking this way, but the ball was here. And I hope that effect worked that I was trying to do.
Yeah, you had a real Doppler situation happening there.
As an audio experience as well.
Yeah, really layered and sound mixing.
Because also, Derek Lively said it at practice in between games 1 and 2, and he said it post game 2, and I had heard through the grapevine, Dallas calls their matchup hunting, where you try to force a switch to go at a specific defender, elephant hunting. And as a writer, the irony is there that the elephant in the room is that Luka Doncic is the elephant that Boston is hunting play after play after play. And they do more than that too. They force him into all this off-ball action. There was one play in the second half, I forget exactly when it was, I think at the start of the fourth quarter, where there was some screen action, I don't remember exactly, between Horford and Derek White on the right wing, and Luka like overjumped it thinking that White was just cutting through the lane, but instead Derek White just peek-a-boo and popped back out to the wing, cash 3. There's so many clips again after there was a 73-second low light reel of him being a matador in game two, of him just getting lost in the rotations in game three, couldn't keep up with Sam Hauser in the corner. He's like standing there one pass away, looks the wrong direction, and the pass comes back at him. He's a phenomenal offensive player. He is the reason why Dallas is at this stage. There are others too. PJ Washington's hot shooting against OKC. Derrick Jones is hot shooting against OKC. Kyrie Irving comes out against the Timberwolves and really helps be a massive co-star. Luka is the the ultimate reason why they are here at this stage.
Yeah,
he is the ultimate reason why Dallas made two Western Conference Finals runs in 3 years. The other one they didn't was when they tanked to get Derek Lively. And that's working out pretty damn well for them. Dan and I were remarking how impressive this kid is in his post-game press conference last night. But his defense, his being Luka, has been abominable. It is far too much for this team to overcome against a two-way team of Boston's caliber. And it's not just that. It's the complaining about the officiating that bleeds into the defense. It's the lack of positioning that led him to several of his fouls. I mean, three of them were because he couldn't keep Jaylen Brown in front of him in a 26-second span at the end of the fourth, his fifth and sixth calls. That one play where he tried to lock up Peyton Pritchard full court, and then Pritchard got by him and he slapped him. And then there was a play where he got into the paint, and it was early in the third, like 8 minute mark of the third, got into the paint and missed and was frustrated. So he just hacked the shit out of Derek White 90 feet from the basket. But it's not just the fouls. It's not just the complaining. It's the flopping on two straight step backs at the end of the second quarter, where one of them, Jason Tatum's guarding him, and he just walks down the court like he's going for a stroll through the Boston Common and gets a wide open dunk. And the slow jog backs on defense after he gets into the paint and is frustrated that he didn't get the foul. You know he's got a bum knee and a bum ankle, and according to Tim McMahon at ESPN, had to get a painkiller injection into his chest. I know he's handling a 35-ish usage rate, which is just remarkable to get through 2 months of the playoffs after the season, after the FIBA World Cup run that we talked about before. But like, if you're going to win at this stage, the Celtics had to endure, you know, the Jaylen Brown cantrip with his left hand and Jason Tatum, the ending criticisms of his shortcomings and their, you know, embarrassment, the egg on their face against Miami last year. They have said throughout this playoff run, we are not the same team as the teams in the past. We have learned from our experiences. We have learned from our mistakes. And this is that opportunity for Dallas. Kyrie Irving said it about Derek Lively in his answer last night, that, you know, we're going to be keep growing together. This is not, it's not just about this finals. We have more years to come. And that is true. Kyrie's on the books for two more years after this. Luka ain't going anywhere. All these other guys, Gafford, PJ Washington, Josh Green, if you want to include him in this group, even Dante Exum. These guys are all still young on the right side of 30 outside of Kyrie. Kyrie's still only 32. LeBron's playing until 40. KD's playing at 35, 36. Kyrie could still have 4 or 5 years left this level. Who knows? But none of this is guaranteed. Mm. Look at Denver. Look at Miami. Look at Milwaukee. Like, they might never get back to this stage. And if they want to get back to this stage, it is 100% on Luka Doncic to look in the mirror and look at his deficiencies here, because he didn't do it last night. And I was chewing over the language that I wanted to ask him in the post-game press conference. Ran it by Dan before I asked him, because to me, if you're going to write a story criticizing one of the greatest players in the game for something that is really about effort and attention, they deserve an opportunity to ask it, to answer to that. And the question was something to the effect of, like, you guys want to hunt these elephants on offense. How does it feel from your perspective to be that target from Boston? And what can you do? What responsibility can you take to improve in that area moving forward? And he blamed the refs.
Yeah. He said, you know, every time I try, they call a foul on me. So, you know, yeah, he did not cover himself in glory at all in the press conference. And Yeah, you're, I mean, you're right to point to the many instances of criticism that he's faced for this before, and the seeming lack of awareness of what to, you know, what needs to change in it, or willingness to change it. And here's where you have to give a little bit of grace to a guy. Like, how often has he been wrong, right, throughout the entirety of his career? Like, he has won everywhere and everything since he's been 13 years old. And this is the instance where it's like, so when somebody says you need to change this thing, and you're like, actually, I'm fine because I'm incredible all the time. And this is hitting into that wall. And great players throughout the history of the NBA have run into the wall and then had to figure out what to change and how to evolve and how to adapt to get over it or break through it. And he is not the first. He will not be the last. But this is
what happened to Anthony Edwards against him a round ago.
But I mean, even at the finals, you know, or before that, you know, there was, you know, Jokic had to, you know, get into the best shape of his career. Giannis mm-hmm. had to, you know, be able to make his free throws. LeBron had to get into the mid post, you know, and on and on and on. Right. Players have had to figure out how to adjust to the way the best opponents that they face and the smartest coaches that they face and the most prepared opponents that they face take advantage of them. And this is the way to take advantage of Luka. Part of it is the emotional component, as you mentioned. And yes, you're right to point to, we have to at least acknowledge the physical limitations he's dealing with. Sprained knee in the first round, who's listed as questionable with ankle soreness in game two, the thoracic contusion. It's also like, he is getting, it's every possession on ball and off ball. And that combined with the on-ball usage where Boston has left him no ground to go to. There is not, like, you know, Jason Kidd said after the game, we have to get him some possessions where he's able to, like, take it easy on offense and rest on offense and somebody else can do it. Well, that is not available to the Dallas Mavericks. The only weapon that the Dallas Mavericks really have against this Celtics offense is hunt a switch, hunt a switch, hunt a switch. Luka
can
gets
I,
downhill.
Can I push back on that?
Go for it.
Because I wrote about it in the season. He had an awesome dunk. The only dunk better than Dante Exum's dunk in game three was Jaylen Brown's. Dante Exum, I'm not going to pull up the numbers, but the Mavs were, their best lineups of the regular season were when they had their three guards, Dante Exum, Kyrie Irving, and Luka Doncic on the floor together. And the fact, I know, and the shot, he was hitting 50% from deep. We talked about it on the show. He was remarkable. That efficiency was never going to translate. But to me, it's been, and I hate to be like rotations guy because there's so much that goes into this stuff that we just don't know, that coaching staffs won't reveal. It's just been surprising to me as Dallas has truly struggled to find any type of creativity outside of Luka Doncic and Kyrie Irving, that Exum doesn't get more of a rope to do that. And it's Jaden Hardy and it's Tim Hardaway Jr. when he has shown an ability to push the pace that this team wants to do. He was one of the only Mavericks players to hit a three that wasn't in Luka Doncic in game two. And he's big enough to compete with all of Boston's huge perimeter players. So I would have been looking for more Dante Exum if I was a Mavericks fan. I think he could be the answer, or could have been the answer to what Kidd's saying too. That was when in game two, Luka got off in the left corner for a three off ball. If you want to give him some rest, like, I don't know, why aren't you using that guy more?
I think that makes sense. And I think that Kidd somewhat, he's pretty sarcastic, like wryly sarcastic in a lot of his pressers. I'm learning that. But so, like, you know, the other day when somebody asked him about the Exum lineups and about pairing Exum and Kyrie particularly, he said, like, well, he was one of the players to make a three in the game. So, like, you know, that's good. We need that.
Your Kidd impression is pretty good.
I've gotten a couple of cracks at it now. I've been listening to him a little bit. Also, I'm pretty sure, because when I asked him a question last night and he started with, yeah, that's a great question. I was like, oh, he hates this question. He is not a fan of this question at all. Anyway,
my favorite Kidd of the playoffs has been, I'm old now. That's why I wear glasses. And it's like, that's not necessarily, or he said it because I've been watching all this film. It's like, well, I don't know if that's how glasses work.
It's like macular degeneration. But anyway.
Optic nerve pressure.
Anyway, you're okay. Yes, Dante Exum can help, but also,
yeah,
if Dante Exum is the answer to the question that you are being posed at this point, you probably have bigger problems to deal with. And I think that there's of the many giant factors in the series, one of them is just the Celtics have identified their best answer all the time is Luka hunting somebody and trying to create something out of it. And it's all physicality. It's never easy. So let's make that guy as tired as humanly possible so that when you get into the fourth quarters of these games, he's not going to have the legs for it. And I think there's something to be said for he gets into the at the end of these games. I think hasn't made a three in the fourth quarter in the series. I don't think he's shooting, I think 3 for 15 in fourth quarters in this series, and only 5 assists in the 3 games. So that's been an across the board thing. The assist rate is down through the basement, the sub basement, the crawl space that Walter White is laughing in. And Dallas was not a great, because they were such an ISO heavy team and they were such a switch hunting team during the regular season. I think it was only 60% assist rate. So bottom 10 in the league. First 3 rounds, it was right around there, 57, 58. It's 40% in this series. They are not getting any creation anywhere. And so that's Joe Mazzulla has not had to adjust what his game plan has needed to be. I mean, obviously he has made individual tactical shifts. And the idea you mentioned of we're going to find a way to make him the low man or him and Kyrie have to make off ball help decisions as often as possible. We are going to leave them no opportunities. But a lot of it is the Mavericks just haven't been able to do enough to make Boston change what it wants to do. And what it wants to do is you do not get corner threes. You do not get lobs. You do not get transition. You get a set defense and make something hard happen 90 times a game. And then when the ball goes down the other end, get ready to get screened, get ready to have to chase, get ready to be under constant siege. And you do that for 38 minutes, 40 minutes, 42 minutes, and there's just nothing, there's no there anymore. And when the other team can go and say, we got 4 guys who can create off the bounce and hit the catch and shoot threes that we create at any given point, or 5 or 6 if Xavier Tillman's in the game,
yeah,
or 7
say,
if it's Sam Hauser.
4?
Yeah, right. It becomes, this series has been really the crucible for Luka Doncic, where there needs to be a physical adjustment in terms of you can handle the rigor and the physicality and the fatigue better than you can now. Not saying that he's some fat out of shape, whatever, but that is something that the best players at the highest levels have to deal with, right? Learn what is required of you physically to be able to get there, and then learn what is required of you emotionally, as you had laid out.
Yeah, as I was laying down last night and trying to chill, go from a finals game, try to go to sleep in 90 minutes. Doesn't really
it is not,
out.
Yeah, not easy. It took me a while too.
I will admit, I wasn't doom scrolling, but I was scrolling. And I came across a video of that game, I think it was game 4, of Luka versus the Clippers in the bubble, where he hit that step back game winner.
Yep.
And he had 40. Holy shit, was that dude a different guy than we watched last night?
He looked about half the size of the guy that we watched last night. But listen, far be it from me to criticize the athleticism.
Dan, what's your workout plan for today, Mike?
Yeah, my workout. I got out for a run yesterday and it wasn't super great. Also, maybe why I had that pounding headache. I should have hydrated more. Yeah, not taking care of myself.
Dallas heat is real, man.
It's no joke. But you are right. The difference is stark. I kind of clocked it because as you're walking out of the arena, there's a big mural of that moment after he hits that shot and everybody's swarming him. And you're how were we ever so young kind of thing? But
yeah, and he's still only 25.
And that's the thing. And so I think the relevant, sort of analogy to make here, not that LeBron ever was in a situation where it's he's got to get in shape.
The 2007 Cavs series.
Absolutely. Yeah. Where it's get this sort of blunt force instrument of here's how we generate offense runs into a team that is nope. And also you are going to have to solve every other problem on the other end. And we don't think you're ready for that yet. And 4-0 sweep. We'll see if history repeats itself there. And then after that series, I remember Tim Duncan going up, there's that famous picture of him hugging LeBron and saying thanks for letting me get one more before it's your league.
I just whispered in the ear.
Oh, I thought you were about to tell me to like shut the fuck up because you have to keep going or whatever. Just more Jake SMR. All right, dynamite.
Yeah.
but don't do it. Don't. I see now. I see it in your eyes. You're gonna make the noise.
You would have better understood if I did this. If I did the pull the corner of your shirt up.
That's right. That's how you know that it's real secret times and you know really high stakes espionage is happening. Anyway, yeah. Like
two max slots.
This is how the greatest players climb the ladder. You have to hit the ceiling. You have to get to a point where you can't climb anymore. And then you have to figure out what is required for you to get up one more rung. The Celtics are putting him through that crucible, through that gauntlet and making it hard on him every step of the way. And if he can't find a way to play through it, if the Mavericks can't find a way to make it easier on him, they finally got Kyrie Irving going last night, 20 in the first half, 35 total. Didn't make a three in the second half, only 5 for 14 from the floor in the second half. So like it dropped off after that. But if they can't find some more answers somewhere, I don't know that we're going back to Boston for a game five.
I don't want to keep harping the Dante Exum thing. I don't want to get clipped and someone on Twitter is like, Jake Fisher just thinks Dante Exum's the answer. But I did pull up the numbers because I felt like I was making an insufficient case and you didn't really necessarily believe me. When all three of Luka, Dante, and Doncic shared the floor during the regular season. This is from my X Factors column that I wrote before the playoffs. It's interesting now seeing it because of what the matchups belied. The Mavs had a 131.9 offensive rating in the regular season with those three guys on the floor, which was 12.3 points per 100 possessions above the Doncic Irving output. And it is higher than the Celtics league leading offense from the regular season. While they're 106.1 defensive rating was 2 points stingier than Minnesota's NBA best mark on the year. So the team they beat in the Western Conference Finals and the team that they're playing now. I just think that was something, I don't know. I would have liked to have seen more Dante. I just would have liked to have seen more Dante.
Especially, I mean, like Jason Kidd was very clear after the game. Like, I think it went 11 players in the first half. And he was like, we're trying to find a spark and it doesn't necessarily have to be shot making, but yes, shot making is important. Like you're cycling through who can give us something. And Maxi Kleber was unable to do so. There's actually a moment last night. This is silly, but it's fun. Press row. There's like where I was sitting, there was two rows of press seats and then there was also fans kind of close by. So as Kleber was taking a shot, there was a point where I heard somebody being on like, nah, Kleber's with us. Kleber's with us. He might be unplayable in this series. And I was like,
he has definitely looked unplayable.
He has. And I was like, oh man, that Celtics fan is really letting Maxi Kleber have it. And then later, a little bit later, somebody was like, that's Eddie House. And I was like, whoa. That makes a lot more sense. And because I hadn't looked over my shoulder to see. I was like, oh, I just figured it was somebody from the stands. Like, oh man, that guy's letting him have it. And yeah, sure enough, Eddie House.
Another story along those lines. So at one point in Boston, I guess it was game one, I had to be held back, not physically, like
restrained. You were so red hot was your fury.
With another bunch of media members, we had to wait, even though there's only one elevator that went up to the 9th floor Halo section, because Adam Silver was getting his whole procession and security detail, like he's the president. So, you know, we couldn't possibly be in the same elevator as Adam Silver, God forbid. So then last night, after the aforementioned running around for the Dave and Buster's cards, the Vinny in our matching suits, I graciously offered to my colleagues to go take up the seat in the nosebleeds. So I'm waiting for the elevator. People leave in front of me. It's like, oh, this is taking so long. I'm like, yes, sunk cost fallacy, baby. And I'm ready to go in. Karam Butler gets escorted by us. And I'm like, no one can take the elevator. This is Karam Butler's elevator. I was like, this guy's an assistant coach who I go say hello to at shoot around when the Heat come to Baruch College in the middle of February. Like, I can't ride the elevator with this guy. And then I found out the whole 2011 Mavs title team was there. And this team did not put up an effort worthy of that. The other thing, I just saw this graphic while we were talking about Luka's defense. This is according to the source's Second Spectrum. Luka has the highest blow-by percentage allowed on drives in a series in NBA history in the last in three of the four series. 2020, all against Boston, against Clippers, and against OKC. So it has been a trend deeper throughout this postseason, not just this finals. And we need to get this thing back on the rails. So Dan, any final thoughts here before we take an ad break, touch on some other things around the NBA?
This pretty clearly feels like the Mavericks missed their best shot at it. There's 156 teams in the NBA have gone down 0-3 in a best of seven series. Not one of them has won the next four games. The Celtics came closest, I think, last year. They got to seven against the Heat, but then Jason Tatum sprains his ankle in the first possession of the game. They wind up getting their doors blown off in Boston in the Eastern Conference Finals.
Last night, Tatum said, "We were just a sprained ankle away from almost doing it." Which is
he's got to think like that. I mean, of course, he's like, yeah, you know, would have been, he's like, you know, wish I would have been out there, like, which is what Lucas said about crunch time last night. He's like, yeah, you know, we were close. We couldn't get it done. I wish I was out there. It's like, well, my brother, you had some say in the matter, but
in any event,
this is like, you know, they were, the glass half full view is they were one or two possessions, in one or two possession games in game two and game three in the final minute. Like, the margins in that sense are not so overwhelming that it's impossible to envision Dallas winning a game in this series, but they have to essentially play perfect and within like very narrowly defined parameters that Boston is allowing them to play in. And Boston, all they have to do is set a ball screen. And so that's like, getting to four, I mean, you know, it's first to four. We got to stay positive. And, you know, all the Mavericks after the game said all the right things and all the things you have to say. We got to make history, Derek Lively said, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. He said, we got to. He didn't guarantee making history, but he said, we've got to. We got to fight like our lives depend on it. And that's great. That's the right mentality. It's the right attitude. And we'll see where they are as we get to practice today before game four. But just the reality of the situation is Boston has so many more ways to create advantages than Dallas does, and they have so many more ways to take away good looks than Dallas does. And I don't see how that fundamentally changes. Perhaps a steadier diet of Dante Exum, although those lineups that you're talking about that were so successful during the regular season, a lot of that is Maxi Kleber at the five. I don't think that's going to work in this series. A lot of that was like Derek Jones Jr. at the four. That seems to be something they want to go away from. Like, at a certain point, you just might not have the answers no matter how far you look down the bench. And that's the position that the Celtics have put them in.
Big problem with the Dante stuff is, you pretty much have to choose between him and Derek Jones Jr., and you're making concessions with that, with those decisions in either direction. Kleba, I mean, he got his, I think it was Jaylen Brown who did it. He got his shot absolutely snuffed on the right wing. It was like early in the game, catches it, looks. I was like, oh, Kleba's looking in rhythm, blocked. And then he's trying to get the miss and he just like fumbled out of bounds. I was like, yeah, Kleba ain't having it still. Sam Hauser did have it. 9 points, 3 or 4 from three. Again, just like standing up on these switches. He's one of the elephants that Dallas is trying to hunt. And he was swinging his trunk and moving his feet.
Nope. Incorrect. Not.
I just wanted to say something to make you react.
I had a feeling that was what you were going for. You're absolutely right. Like, those guys, the Dallas is looking, keeps circling these guys and saying, that's who we got to go after. And they're like, all those guys are holding up. Horford is holding up on switches. Xavier Tillman's holding up on switches. The cops are coming because Sam Hauser can't get beat up on switches.
Yeah. Because Peyton Pritchard, of six I saw going against Peyton Pritchard. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, that's, if that is your best answer, and understandably, it's what you go after. But if that's not getting you anything, then where are you getting something? And we've been asking the same questions for three games, and it's maybe at a point where there isn't an answer.
That's why this might just be a four-game sweep. We will find out more on Friday, and we will talk more about the league after this ad break. Welcome back to No Cap Room here on the Ball Don't Lie podcast. We wrapped plenty on Boston being on the doorstep of Banner 18. Finishing the unfinished business that has eluded this franchise since 2022. And again, as we've discussed in the past, 28 other teams are still focused on the offseason.
Right.
We're watching these games Denver people are shaking their heads, thinking it could have been us. But people want to know, people in the league want to know what's going to happen with the two open head coaching jobs. There's also a third head coaching situation that is still theoretically unresolved in Detroit, where new president of basketball operations, Trajan Langdon, has the capacity, if he so chooses, to move on from head coach Monty Williams. That has been an ongoing discussion since April. That would be like complicated buyout for sure.
And the word, at this point, would walking away from Monty Williams at this point be like, what's better than gold? Like a platinum parachute? Like a diamond parachute? You know,
it would be about what, like a $67 million parachute, something like that.
Yeah. I mean, you could make a pretty cool parachute out of all that paper, I guess, but that's.
You can. The Cleveland Cavaliers head coaching search and the Lakers head coaching search, though, have been overlapping to some extent because of one, James Borrego, the Pelicans associate head coach, who was the head coach in Charlotte previously, got the Hornets to two play-in games, and now he's, by all accounts, is positioned as the leader right now. After we're recording this on Thursday, he met with Cleveland people on Tuesday, all day Tuesday. They have Kenny Atkinson and Mike Anori in the building in person the rest of this week, as we reported on Yahoo Sports yesterday. Those are definitely the three guys that are being viewed around the league as the quote-unquote finalists for this job. The Cavs are still Zooming with other candidates, and they're telling coaching agents, we're not done yet. Like, your guy might get an in-person thing. To me, I'm just reading the tea leaves as I can. To me, it seems like those guys are like, oh, if the in-person things don't necessarily work out, we will be calling you.
Right.
So that, to me, is where this thing is focused. Right now, it does seem like James Borrego, again, is the leader for the Cavs job, but so many people have been leaders for coaching jobs in the past that has not come to fruition, whether they weren't able to land the plane or the team couldn't sign them to a contract, as happened in Los Angeles with Dan Hurley over the weekend. So there's plenty of moving parts here. And we'll stick with Cleveland for a second before we get to the Lakers part of it at all, because one thing that was consistent that I've heard throughout all my conversations about that job is that Cleveland is really focused on this next man on their sidelines to be an offensive innovator, someone with creativity who can figure out how to use two diminutive guards and have them also prop up two giant centers who don't exactly have collaborative skill sets. And there's this tug and pull of what position Evan Mobley naturally plays and what have you. But I don't know. You look at other huge teams playing two bigs and they seem to work out just fine if one of them can shoot league average from distance. So that is the hope with Evan Mobley. Definitely not the hope with Jared Allen. I think that hope has long since sailed. He is truly a rim runner, and that's why him and Donovan Mitchell can just be together of the two out of the four and win like 18 straight games or whatever it was in the winter. So Kenny's been there from a developmental standpoint with JA, with Caris LeVert in Brooklyn. Mike Anori has definitely been someone who's been credited for helping Denver in the past with their new offensive principles, just like Chris Finch was when they were shifting to a Nikola Jokic offense. And of course, he stepped up when Chris Finch suffered a knee injury throughout these playoffs and kind of really pushed Micah further into the next head coaching up ranks. But Borrego seems to be like the quote-unquote offensive guru here that really is taking pole position of this, because the Cavs, as we've been saying, they have no interest in trading Darius Garland. You know, the Spurs get talked about, but like, what would the number 4 pick and the number 8 pick in theory and like Keldon Johnson do for Cleveland right now when they just fired their head coach because they want to get further into the playoffs? You know what I mean? It's going to be, you know, there's a match made in heaven in theory of just swapping Brandon Ingram for Darius Garland, which would be, I think, fun for New Orleans side of things. But I don't know if the Cavs are so keen on doing that trade and then having to be the ones to pay the very hefty extension that Brandon Ingram would like, that is throwing his situation in New Orleans in flux. So I'm of the mind that in Cleveland, we're going to be seeing this core four. Everyone around the league is pretty of the mind that Donovan will be signing a shorter extension. That the prevailing thought is he would do something more of like in a 3-year range. To like, that way, when he gets back into free agency, he would have 10 years of service and be eligible for a higher percentage of the cap, which is going to be like $700 million per season by that point. So right now, seems like one of those three guys is going to be the one tasked with optimizing all that. And right now, seems like it's James Borrego's job to lose. He set the tone Tuesday at the first in-person meeting. So everyone else, just by sheer how life works, they will be compared to how that first in-person interview went.
And he's the only one that I could, of those three, obviously Mike Anora has not been a head coach at this level before, so he doesn't have the track record in that regard outside of this postseason run where he stepped to the front of the bench for Chris Finch, as you mentioned. But Kenny Atkinson, we've got several years of him being a head coach in Brooklyn. Obviously, the talent that he was coaching in Brooklyn was, that was very much the like, churn the roster, find, set up a system, and then find guys because they were strip mined of assets following the Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce trade. So that was like, he had to build that organization up and build that roster up. So he was not dealing with all-star talent, right? But James Borrego, you can actually look at when he took over in Charlotte. The first iteration that he had was still built around Kemba Walker, and that was a near top 10 offense. Then he gets LaMelo Ball after a couple of down years, and it's a near top 5 offense. So like, we've actually seen him generate and create an offense that can get into the upper reaches of the offensive efficiency standings, that can like buoy a team and get it into competitive, into a more competitive context, even with lacking talent or lacking defense or youth or whatever. The thing that's, I mentioned this when we talked about Cleveland before, the thing that remains interesting to me is just if your main candidates are guys who have been like rebuild coaches to get you to a certain level of competitiveness and not ones who have proven that they can win playoff series, that they can game plan deep into the playoffs, that they can be the team that can elevate you past 50 wins in the second round. Like, that's where Cleveland is. And those guys don't exactly grow on trees. And when they're around, many teams want to hang on to them. So that's kind of the challenge that they're facing. They're looking for a creative solution to a problem that a lot of organizations have faced, including the Lakers, who find themselves, they go from a championship winning coach to a Western Conference Finals winning coach to searching again. And, at a certain point, it becomes, what does success even look like in that job? And I think that's the question a lot of people are trying to answer in LA.
Yeah, I think from everything I have been told, success for the next head coach in the Lakers will be both optimizing whatever years are left of LeBron James' career and setting forth principles and establishing a playing style, a culture, what have you, that can exist beyond LeBron's days with Anthony Davis as the centerpiece of things. One thing, Anthony Davis, I remember Herculean effort on both sides of the floor in the in-season tournament championship. He has had plenty of moments of being a dominant two-way force where he's looked like, holy hell, is this guy one of the top 10 players in the league again? He has not, to me, been that consistently enough where the Lakers should be so confident that he's the next guy that can just take this thing forward. It will be very curious to see if they end up actually making a move for some third banana that they've kind of been missing all along since the AD and LeBron partnership came together when he was traded from New Orleans to Los Angeles in 2019, which I was talking about this with someone on the phone earlier this week. Like, the free agency market is not robust in terms of players who are going to be actually available for the taking and teams that actually have cap space. 2019 feels so long ago.
It really does.
Anthony Davis was traded to LA, but when you had, and Paul George was traded to the Clippers, but when you had Kawhi choose the Clippers and you had KD and Kyrie choose Brooklyn, and even like Gordon Hayward, if you want to talk about the lineage of this Boston team, like Gordon Hayward taking meetings and figuring out his stuff. That stuff feels like such a bygone era because that just isn't how it's happening. Even with I don't think I've written this yet, so it is kind of new content for our Yahoo Sports audience. Even if Paul George were to leave the Clippers this year, there is definitely a prevailing school of thought that he might not opt out of his player option for next season and just sign on the open market, that it would actually behoove him and the Clippers to opt in and then get traded and then sign an extension after that. So if that were to happen, which again, I'm not saying it will, I'm not saying he's gonna leave the Clippers, but just something people are talking about.
At least an option on the board.
Yeah. And look, if he looks to his right in the locker room, James Harden just did that a couple months ago. So that would be another player not moving through free agency. The Lakers, to bring us back there, they had talks with Atlanta about DeJounte Murray. We have reported that. They had talks about other things. But they decided we're going to wait till this summer in order to have access to 3 first-round picks, and we'll figure it out then. Donovan Mitchell might come up. You know, there's the Zach LaVine price that's, in theory, just only going down. Could we trade for Garland? Could we trade for Trey? Like, it's been pretty quiet about that, as they've just been, all the talk about the Lakers has been about this head coaching thing. And I've heard plenty of people that they are considering at number 17. There's talk of the Lakers wanting to move up a little bit. If they stay at 17, heard plenty about them looking for bigs. Devin Carter, the Providence guard, shout out Friars. He seems to be someone that the Lakers seem to like. I've been told that that would be his absolute floor, but I don't think he'll be anywhere close. I don't think he's getting out of the lottery, let alone even out of the top 10. We'll see. His dad works for Memphis. A lot of thought that maybe he could go there. Maybe he could go elsewhere. Who's to say? But all this is to say that there is so much more to this Lakers puzzle than just if J.J. Redick is going to be the guy for this job. So the fact that J.J. Redick does seem to be the guy for this job, I think, is also exemplary of the fact that the Lakers are just kind of like a influx team. They are not exactly a championship contender. Although they got to the Western Conference Finals a year ago, they've been in the play-in tournament every year. They are a play-in tournament perennial team. That, in this new league or era of parity, doesn't mean what I think the league thought it would have meant when it first started, for good reason. Like, it is great for the NBA. It is great for the overall playoff theater that some team, such as Miami last year to the finals, the Lakers all the way to the Western Conference Finals, can do that. But I don't think anyone around the NBA truly believes that this Lakers roster as constructed last year, and like with D'Angelo Russell having a player option decision to make, that if you polled 100 people in the NBA, I would guess 93% of them said D'Angelo Russell should pick that up, because I don't see him getting more money on the open market.
Mm.
People talk about Orlando. I haven't talked to anyone in Orlando, I will admit publicly, about D'Angelo Russell being on the radar, but I can guarantee you D'Angelo Russell is not on the Orlando Magic radar for more money than what he's potentially on the books for in LA. So I know this is going like very off task, but these are bigger conversations that the Lakers have to have. And it'll be interesting, like this whole thing of, will it be JJ? Will it be Dan Hurley? Will it be Borrego? Like, once they get done with this decision, to me, is when the interesting stuff in LA actually will occur.
I get that, because if for no other reason than it seems like you are basically just renting if you're the coach of the Lakers at this point. Like, what of what certainty can you have beyond like a year at this point in that job? And yes, the what happens after LeBron is the most fascinating part of it. LeBron obviously also holds the cards there, and he can decide what he wants to do with his player option, and with, you know, if he wants to extend
and
go.
He's re-signing with the Lakers.
Well, I'm just saying, I don't think that he's not. I when we did our round table about like, is fact or fiction, LeBron James is on the, I think everybody picked fact. You know, I don't think anybody sees him not being there, but
By process of elimination, he's not taking anything less than the max, and the only teams that can offer him that are Philly, where I've been told, and I also just from looking at it, Don't expect him to hitch his wagon to a perennially injured Joel Embiid.
Right.
Is he going to Utah?
I don't think so.
Is he going to Detroit?
Are they're going to be able to pay him and Monty? Can they do both?
No cap room for coaches. So
yeah, I don't know. Maybe he decides to go to San Antonio. You're right. Yeah, there's no reason to believe that he's not going to do it. I'm just saying, as you talk about the different decision points and inflection points and whatever, that's one of them. And then what does that contract look like and how long is it and what kind of horizon are you looking at there? I think the interesting thing to me is just like, what do they want to be? You're right to say I don't think you can just look at it and say it's Anthony Davis's team, because Anthony Davis he made all NBA second team this year. He didn't make all NBA the last several years before that, in part because of injury and lack of availability and things like that. Anthony Davis is not a perennial first team all NBA player anymore. He's not a perennial top five player. He's closer to 10 to 15 than he is to 5 to 1. And that's still a really good player. But yes, you don't build the entire plane around him in the same way that you wouldn't just say we're signing Paul George to be our number one option and expecting to be awesome, right? Like those guys are great players, but they need to be buttressed by other great players. So what is the vision? What, do you want and you mentioned James Borrego as the sort of like offensive optimization agent. All right. If not him, if you don't wind up with JJ Redick because he doesn't want to be viewed as the second choice or because he doesn't knock his interview out of the park or whatever. Right. The things that have been forwarded. I know Vinny had mentioned that there was some concern around the league about, JJ maybe not wanting to sign up for the circus or, be viewed as the second choice after all the Dan Hurley stuff. And if it's not James Borrego, because he winds up being the guy in Cleveland, where do you find that answer? John Gennaro, super producer, put the notes in the doc. Like Dan had some good ideas. Dan just scratched out some thoughts very quickly on a plane on the way to our to Dallas. So, but my question was like, if you are looking for an offensive, an offensive guy, someone who has been part of good offenses, someone who has a lot of experience in crafting different kinds of offenses, who's had a lot of input, maybe that's, you give Sam Cassell a call when he gets done with the Celtics run. Maybe that's David Adelman in Denver. You've seen up close and personal how that Denver offense can work. The difficult positions that it can put you in defensively. I wonder what the next answer is if it's not Borrego and if it's not Redick, but we might not even get to that point. Whatever decision winds up being made, obviously all eyes are going to be on it, because no matter how good or bad or relevant or whatever they are.
I hate the all eyes expression. Not all eyes will be on it. My eyes will be on it. I'm going to be reading a book before my eyes are glued to this situation.
Jake, you're talking about like getting patched into three-way calls with coaches about what's going to happen, 18 hours from now and 2 weeks from now and where Devin Carter's floor is in 2 weeks. Like, your eyes are on this stuff. I'm glad you're reading. That's wonderful.
All eyes are not on the Lakers coaching job. You think people in Kamchatka care about the Lakers job? Like, what a terrible expression. I hate it. I hate it so much.
A whole lot of people who give a shit about NBA basketball stuff are going to be paying attention to which guy's coaching the Los Angeles Lakers next year. Fair adjustment.
Much better.
All right. Whichever direction they wind up going, it'll draw a lot of interest within our stupid world, whether Kamchatka isn't part of that or not.
Yeah. Last thing I'll say, because it was suggested I talk about it in some respect. The Dan Hurley thing, I just want to go on record and state the Lakers would not have offered him $70 million. They would not have flown him to Los Angeles if that was not a real thing.
Right.
That's all I'll say. The league is rife with tinfoil hats, and some of them lightning strikes and it turns out to be correct. But I do not think that situation was just a clear-cut conspiracy where it was all a sham to get Dan Hurley more money from UConn, because the Lakers met with him and they offered him money, a lot of money that has not been available to them, that they did not make available to Ty Lue a couple years ago, which if they had offered that contract to him, maybe none of us would be having this conversation and the Lakers would be in a much different circumstance. The JJ Redick being like the Lakers for like top priority and he hasn't actually met with them in person, yada yada, Like, yes, I do believe Reddick has been the clear-cut favorite for this job, with Borrego right behind the mix all along. Borrego apparently has a connection with Anthony Davis still after all these years, even after they only overlapped for like a month or so after Davis was drafted in 2012, I believe, the year after Kyrie at 2011. Mm-hmm. That's how my brain works to remember these things. The year before Anthony Bennett going number one. And that connection has apparently served Borrego well enough to be involved in this search to such a degree. But the fact that Redick could not have left his post calling these finals certainly opened the door for the Lakers to look into other opportunities. And when Gino Auriemma's contract extension happened with UConn, and then that kind of signaled, I mean, the NBA and the college coaching industries are very overlapped because assistants go back and forth, mm-hmm. and the agents who handle college coaches, a lot of them also handle, like, Brett Just is Dan Hurley's agent. He is James Borrego's agent as well. Like, all this information and all this business overlaps for sure. So when the women's coach of UConn gets a new deal done, and then like those talks are going to be happening on the men's side, word gets back to the Lakers that he's not wrapped up and your search isn't wrapped up. Like, to me, 2 and 2 can't equal 4 more so than 17 sometimes. So that's all I have to say there. And I think that's all we have to say on this episode of No Cap Room. Thank you to super producer John Gennaro, who does all the things to make this show look and sound great. Subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube, please, on or whatever podcast platform you're currently listening on, and leave us a 5-star review. We thank you for listening, and we'd appreciate it. We came back again next week for another episode of No Cap Room.